So tonight I'm going to be lecturing on what is thankfulness without God. And I realized a few days ago as I was coming back to this lecture to try to work on it, that the title sounds a little bit, or could be heard as being a little bit dismissive or combative in its tone. And I sort of realized this too late, long after the lecture title was published in our lecture schedule and on our webpage and everything like that. It's not meant to be a jab at anybody at all. My fear is that it could be heard as implying that only believers in God can be thankful people, which some Christians say, that to be an atheist makes it impossible to express gratitude, or that gratitude cannot be an important value to a non-believer, or that non-Christians aren't being genuine when they experience gratitude. And I'm not trying to say any of these things. If that was implied by the title, then maybe that's why it's a small crowd tonight. I don't know. But but I don't think any of those claims are true or wise to make. My title is actually an honest question meant to be taken at face value. So in the lives of people who do not believe in the personal God of the Bible, which includes people of a huge diversity of different beliefs, not just professing atheists. What is thankfulness? How does it work? Where does it come from? What drives it? How is it expressed? How does it function in their lives? How is it articulated? What does it amount to? What is thankfulness if you do not believe in the personal God of the Bible? To a non-Christian who does not believe in the giver of every good and perfect gift, so how James describes the Lord. If you do not believe in the giver of every good and perfect gift, what is the attitude towards gifts? I do think that the Judeo-Christian account of who God is gives a unique foundation and a unique motivation for thankfulness as a way of life. And thanksgiving in isolation from the personal God of the Bible presents certain challenges. That's one of the things I want to talk about tonight. Challenges that I think should be accounted for, or acknowledged at least. but that's not to say that only Christians can be grateful. So that's my disclaimer. I decided the best way to approach this is to kind of get a running start and talk a bit about what thankfulness even is before we go any further. In the Christian faith, first of all, sorry, this is my outline. I'm going to talk, after my introduction, talk a little bit about a contemporary fascination and attraction to gratitude. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the anatomy of gratitude, what are the parts of it, some other views of gratitude that we might not have thought of, and then finally kind of building up to this question, is secular gratitude enough? What does it amount to? But first of all, I wanted to, by way of introduction, just talk a little bit about the supreme importance of thanksgiving to the Christian faith. It's not an exaggeration to say that thankfulness is of supreme importance. To live a life of gratitude is not a lifestyle choice among other equally valid lifestyle choices. That's not what the Bible teaches. It clearly teaches that to live a life of thankfulness is the only truthful way to live. So thankfulness is the appropriate and fitting response to the truth. To live in light of reality. And what reality is it living in light of? Well, first of all, God is the creator. We have life only because he's given it to us and continues to give it to us each day. He's redeemed us at dreadful cost to himself. The events that we're preparing to celebrate during Holy Week, for the joy of welcoming us back as beloved children. And he has promised a new creation in which everything that's been broken will be one day made whole again. So these are massive promises encompassing the whole large narrative of the Bible. If we believe them, our response should be thanksgiving. That's the appropriate response to those core beliefs of the Christian faith. Even as life circumstances change, these big truths of the Christian faith do not change. And so that's one of the aspects of thanksgiving that's really important. Thanksgiving is an appropriate thing all the time, no matter how bad life circumstances happen to be. Paul says, give thanks in all things, in all circumstances. Significantly, he does not say for all things and for all circumstances, because some things are just bad, and we're totally right to lament certain things in the world and in our lives. But he says, be prepared to give thanks in all circumstances, which means there must be certain things that we can hold on to firmly that are true and never change, that are grounds for thanksgiving, regardless of what happens to be going on right now in my life. Remember, Nikki and I attended an Anglican church for several years when we lived in Vancouver, and I remember part of the Anglican liturgy is stuck in my head, where the priest says, "Let us give thanks unto our Lord God," and the people say, "It is meet and right so to do." Meet in this context means it is a generally accepted, non-controversial thing. You know, this is what we do. It's meet. Anyway, it is meet and right so to do. And the priest says, it is very meet, right, and our bounden duty that we should at all times and in all places give thanks unto thee, our Lord, Holy Father, Almighty, Everlasting God, through Jesus Christ, thine only Son, our Lord. So this idea that thanksgiving is meet and right, the meet and right response to life, seems to be Jesus' view of thanksgiving too. Just looking at one very brief passage in Luke 17, where Jesus is walking along and he comes across 10 men who are suffering from leprosy. And he tells them to go show themselves to the priest. And on their way to see the priest, they realize that they've been cleansed, they're healed. And presumably they then go and show themselves to the priests so that they can be declared clean in the community. And then one of them returns to say thank you to Jesus. He finds Jesus. He tracks him down and in order to say thank you. And it's fascinating that Jesus does not consider his behavior to be extraordinary or pious in particular. He doesn't say, you know, he eventually says, your faith has healed you, go. But he doesn't say, wow, you're really great for coming back to say thank you. The one man who comes back to say thank you to Jesus seems to be doing the obvious thing. The minimum requirement to come back, find the one that healed you and saved your life, and to say thank you. What Jesus considers noteworthy is that the other 9 did not return to say thank you. That's what he comments on. Where are the other ones? There were 10 of you. And so, to me, that speaks volumes in terms of what Jesus' expectation is. To be thankful is to live reality. To be unthankful is to be out of touch with reality. It's to be living a lie in some way or other, and one could argue that those other 9 lepers who realized they were healed and then decided to just forget about how this came about and move on with their lives were out of touch with reality. So it's to reject, to be ungrateful is to reject the most foundational truth. And because of this, naturally it has bad consequences. So ingratitude, and moving on to this whole notion of universal ingratitude, the Christian faith declares that thankfulness is living the truth and it's essential. Yet, ingratitude has been the besetting sin of all humanity from the very beginning. It's a universal failure to give appropriate thanks to God. At its root, this is what the Bible calls idolatry. To refuse to recognize God as the one who provides everything. And to inevitably set up other gods in his place. So when you refuse to acknowledge God as the giver of every good gift, you turn elsewhere. You don't just remain neutral. Adam and Eve, with the help of Satan, they look around at the endless beauty and diversity of creation that God has given them for their good, for their enjoyment, for their sustenance, for their thriving. And yet they allow their minds to become obsessed with the one prohibition, the one thing they were told they could not have. And that focusing on the one prohibition, again with the help of the serpent in the story, subtly shifts their perception of God. From being a giver of good things to being a withholder of good things. And it's this subtle, twisted understanding of who God is. He's maybe not just a giver of good things. Maybe he's a withholder. It's that lie about who God is that is the beginning of all problems. Paul in Romans 1 says, "For although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God nor gave thanks to him. But their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened." So if you think of that, that's just, it's rich language. But you think of everything that's implied in the words, futile thinking and darkened hearts. Endless litany of human foolishness and rebellion and destruction that's come from that. Somewhere at its root, it's all a refusal to give thanks to God. So to acknowledge good things in life as gifts from God is a safeguard, I think, against making those very things into false gods. If something is a gift, it can't be God. Because there's someone bigger behind it. If it's a gift, it's been given. And if you acknowledge that something is a gift from God, that gift is not going to be made into a god by you. If I say thank you to God for my family, say, family is something that's, you know, becomes an idol in many people's lives because it's such a good thing. But if I say thank you to God for my family, and I really mean that, I really am acknowledging that he's the one that's given me my family, I'm not going to make an idol out of my family. But if we refuse to recognize the gifts of God, we are incredibly likely to make gods out of those gifts. And so, all the good things that God has given us, if we can recognize them and hold on to them as gifts and honor them as gifts, we're actually, like I said, it's a tremendous safeguard against worshiping those things. Because if it's a gift, then there's someone bigger than that gift that's given it to us. And he's the one to be worshipped. Ingratitude has always been our problem. It's a perennial human problem. It's at the root of idolatry. There's nothing new about that. But today, I think there's unique cultural things going on, and one of which is that we live in a culture of entitlement. This is one of the greatest contemporary obstacles to thankfulness, I think, which you could describe entitlement as an unexamined attitude of deservedness. Because it's unexamined, it can be totally irrational, it can make no sense at all, and yet we can still live by its principle if we don't examine it. Entitlement is an attitude that good things are simply our due. That the life we desire is somehow owed to us. In the same way that certain rights are due a person with the title of king, right? If you are a king, you have a title, and then certain rights are due you because you have that title. We act as if we have titles. That's where the term entitlement comes from. And yet very few of us have titles, right? There are all kinds of reasons why people assume this and live in this way. Maybe there's versions of entitlement. Maybe you've worked really hard your whole life and you are entitled to what you have. I worked my butt off for this. I deserve it. Maybe you've just been spoiled and you're entitled. It doesn't matter what the source of the entitlement is. The result is usually the same. If you feel entitled to a particular good thing in life, you can never recognize that thing as a gift. So to be given your due and to receive a gift are two mutually exclusive things. You can't view something as being owed to you and a gift at the same time. If you are entitled to something, there is no reason to thank anybody. If you receive a gift, then there is a reason to thank somebody. One could argue that in the West, I think we're living in a uniquely entitled generation right now. I don't know whether that can be proven, but one wonders. Our advertisements are very, very good at telling us what we deserve, and it's something that the world of advertisement reinforces all of our entitled tendencies, I think. We deserve great jobs, great friends, great family, great vacation, great sex, great cars, great everything, and we're supposed to go out and buy those things because we deserve them. And we believe it, lots of us. Right? So much so that we do not receive, when we do not receive what we think we are owed, it's construed as a denial of our rights. We have a grievance. We've been wronged. And this is one of the reasons why to be entitled is, in the end, to be miserable. So entitlement is not a happy road to tread in the end. Because life inevitably will disappoint you, and then you're in a position where every disappointment is construed as a violation of your rights. And people don't have to be Christians to notice this. I mean, ingratitude doesn't lead to a happy life or an attractive life. And lots of people can recognize that fact. Whereas gratitude seems to lead to both. Gratitude seems to lead to both a happy life and an appealing life. So as a result, there's a growing appreciation of gratitude, I think, as a worthy virtue. It may be a reaction against all the entitlement that's in our culture. I don't know. But there's a growing appreciation of gratitude as a virtue among people who have no commitment to the Christian faith at all. And this is really the area that I want to focus on. So this is the end of my introduction. Actually, no, it's not. But this is the main thing that I want to focus on: the contemporary attraction to gratitude among people who profess no particular faith. Many atheists hail gratitude as a worthy way of life and an important value, but so do many people with a variety of very spiritually vague views. If you think of the people that say, "I'm a spiritual person, but I'm not religious," or people who in this country are influenced by a whole variety of different kinds of Eastern thought, Buddhism, Zen, Hinduism, who sort of take it all on board and live fairly spiritually vague lives. Gratitude is acknowledged by these people as well as a beautiful, appealing, life-affirming discipline with all kinds of tangible benefits. So it seems to me that there is an opportunity for a conversation between Christians and non-Christians here when it comes to gratitude. If you think of the number of shared values that if you're a Christian, what are the number of shared values that you have with the people that are non-Christians around you? There are some, but we're in a climate right now where it seems like there's less and less. If you go out and want to express something about your Christian values in the public square, you're right to think that you may be walking into hostile territory. You're going to receive pushback and resistance about all kinds of things that you believe as a Christian. But when it comes to the importance of gratitude, there's actually some common ground. Not across the board. I think a Christian view of gratitude is going to be different on some very key points. But gratitude is a touch point where we as Christians can, in good conscience, affirm the same values as our non-Christian friends. At least enough to have a good conversation. Many non-Christian people today connect passionately with the beauty and the goodness of gratitude, and I think that's right, rightly so. It is beautiful. It is an attractive, appealing thing in a person if someone is a grateful person. It's also good, and goodness can be defined in all different kinds of ways, but in our culture today, the goodness of gratitude is defined as it leads to very healthy life choices. It produces good things. It's good for you to be thankful. But the Christian person, I think, can affirm those things. It's good and it is beautiful, but is in a unique position to wholeheartedly, while affirming those, also point to the truth of it. It's not just good and beautiful, it is true. So to the Christian, the truth of gratitude, that is simply to acknowledge the reality of God's blessings, that's the truth of gratitude, is the foundation for its beauty and its goodness. Gratitude looks beautiful because it corresponds to the deepest truths. Gratitude leads to human thriving, goodness, because it corresponds to those deepest truths. That's why. So I want to look more deeply at this, at the sort of culture that seems to be enamored with gratitude. And I'm going to be talking about a lot of things in passing that I really don't know much about. Including yoga, and in a little while I'm going to even have to mention Twitter, which I hardly even understand. So you just have to trust me that don't press me on any technical things. So across a very wide spectrum of beliefs, gratitude gets good press. I'll just give a few examples, and they're all sort of positive perspectives on gratitude. How many people practice yoga here? Anybody? I do not, or I haven't yet, but for people who do, the sun salutation, anyone know what that is?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. A well-known series of yoga positions designed to stretch and tone your muscles. The sun salutation is also a way of giving thanks. So In the words of one yoga instructor, the sun salutation gives us an opportunity to express gratitude to the sun, without which life on earth would be impossible. So it's another thing that gets said a lot, according to my wife, in yoga classes, is inhale love, exhale gratitude. Inhale love, exhale gratitude. Which is to, in a disciplined way, interpret each breath as a gift worthy of thanks. Right? This is an intentional interpretation of what you're experiencing by breathing. Other people talk about the discipline of, with each breath, when you're doing yoga, think of something that you're thankful for each breath, and sustain that for a whole session. That's very hard. But there's something challenging and good about these things. I mean, I really appreciate this, actually. Not easy, but important. An attitude of thankfulness is incorporated into the physical practices of yoga because thankfulness is recognized as an important part of holistic wellness, your whole self. Training the mind towards gratitude will benefit the whole person, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So that's all I'm going to say about yoga. I know there's a lot more that could be said. In the positive psychology movement, this is something, again, that I don't know a whole lot about, although it's a movement in psychology that is branching away from Freudian psychology, which focuses on pathologies in order to understand how the human mind works. The positive psychology movement asks the question, what can we learn about the human mind by looking at psychologically healthy people, the people who are high achievers, the people who are thriving? What can we learn from them about the human mind? So, within the positive psychology movement, gratitude has been recognized as an important aspect of psychological health. There are many, many studies that demonstrate this. Practicing gratitude in some way can make people happier, less stressed, more emotionally secure, more generous, more successful in their social interactions, more successful professionally as well. Dr. Robert Immons, he wrote this book called Thanks, How Practicing Gratitude Can Make You Happier. And he is a psychologist within this positive psychology movement. I'd recommend this book, actually. It's good. But he says, he and among others have used his studies on gratitude to challenge the conventional wisdom about human happiness. So psychologists often talk about a set point for happiness. That's the technical term, a set point, that each individual has. And this is basically a genetically determined level of happiness that you will have that's unique to you. It's your baseline status quo sort of emotional state. Some people are just naturally perky. Some people are naturally morose, and there's all kinds of different points in between those two. It can rise when things are going well. It can sink when things are going badly. But eventually, inevitably, a person's emotions will always adjust back to their set point, which is sort of a depressing thought. It's a very deterministic kind of approach, although there's some evidence for it. Emmons believes that intentionally cultivating gratitude can shift this set point. So a person can not only experience more moments of happiness in their life, they can actually become a happier person through practicing gratitude. He doesn't quite buy into the deterministic model that there's nothing people can do to change, right? That their set point is just, they're just going to click back into it no matter what. In addition, I think studies also indicate that there are many physiological benefits to gratitude. People who intentionally practice gratitude sleep better. They wake up more refreshed. They get sick less often. There's been lots of studies that indicate this. There's a tidal wave. Now, in response to all these scientific studies, there's a tidal wave of popular literature that's sort of responding to them and using them in different ways. So lots and lots of articles in popular health magazines, for instance, referring back to, you know, studies showing. And so if you go online, this is a couple months ago that I did this internet search, but I'm sure there's more things that are available now. But a brief internet search will yield these titles. Boost Your Health with a Dose of Gratitude from WebMD. Gratitude Health Benefits, Huffington Post. Expanding the Science and Practice of Gratitude, Greater Good, Science Center. Count Your Blessings, How Gratitude Improves Your Health. In Praise of Gratitude, Harvard Health Publications. The 31 Benefits of Gratitude You Didn't Know About. 5 Reasons Why Gratitude is Good for Your Health. The Mental Health Benefits of Gratitude. A Serving of Gratitude Brings Healthy Dividends. And then one article, which was my favorite, it ends with this quote that says, "Gratitude is no cure-all, but it is a massively underutilized tool for improving life satisfaction and happiness." So first of all, it's referred to as a tool, significant, and underutilized, which is true. More people should really try it out. And on and on and on and on. This is just like the top handful of things that came up on a search. So general observations about all of this literature that's out there responding to studies that have been done. Okay. Now this is just very, very general. It doesn't apply to every single one. But number one, these are under observations here. They all stress the benefits of cultivating internal feelings of gratitude. Internal feelings, but not necessarily internal feelings that are ever expressed outwardly. There are health benefits to be reaped simply by feeling thankful, without necessarily saying thank you to anyone in particular. This is where we see the difference between gratitude and thanksgiving, which is... I haven't been very precise with my words here. Sometimes I use them interchangeably, but actually there is a difference between gratitude and thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is thanks that is given, right? It is an outward expression of gratitude. Gratitude is good, but it doesn't necessarily translate to an outward expression. Much of gratitude described in these studies and in these articles is a feeling experienced by yourself and for yourself. If the feeling of gratitude is achieved, then it's mission accomplished. Even if you're grateful for what someone else has done for you, even if that's the actual thing you're thankful for. And so I thought I was really clever and came up with this term. It's thanksgiving rather than thanksgiving. But then I looked it up online and someone else had already thought of that. But so then, anyway. Thanksgiving. Rather than thanksgiving. It's still thanks, but it's something that you cherish inside and never express. So, this I think... can function, not necessarily, but it can function as dodging a bullet in a certain way. It avoids one of the most challenging aspects of thankfulness, and that is publicly acknowledging your dependence on somebody else. To say thank you is to admit that you have had a need and someone else has met it. You are not self-sufficient when you receive the gift. Outward thanks requires a level of humility that inward gratitude does not require necessarily. It's possible to experience feelings of internal gratitude while remaining self-satisfied and proud. And I think some of the writing from advanced practitioners of gratitude sounds a little self-satisfied at times. Secondly, the motivation for practicing gratitude is that it has the power to improve our lives. That's the motivation. You could call this a pragmatic or instrumental motivation for gratitude. Be grateful because it works. It's largely about benefit and outcomes. The quote I read before that referred to gratitude as an underutilized tool, that kind of is what I'm talking about. In a lot of the popular literature, that's the extent of the reasons offered for cultivating gratitude. If it helps me stay fit and shed stress and feel more fulfilled and have better relationships, why wouldn't I practice gratitude? Sounds like a really great idea. Great choice. And it's almost on par with eating organic food or taking multivitamins in a lot of health magazines. Literally, it's part of the same conversation. It's not distinguished as being anything different in quality. The implication here, gratitude is not presented as a moral necessity, right? It's not a true response to life. It's not right or wrong or true or false. It's a healthy life choice. something that you can choose or not, though. It may even be something we owe ourselves, just to practice gratitude, rather than something we morally owe someone else. Thirdly, not surprisingly, if anything has been shown to have great health benefits, then it will be reduced to a technique because everyone will want to do it in as little time as possible, right? So, so gratitude is reduced to a technique with guaranteed results for people with busy lives. And so this is one of the aspects of, and I don't mean to condescend to gratitude journals. I think it's probably a really good discipline for most of us. But gratitude journals, this idea of having a little book that each day you set aside time to write in the things you're thankful for. Again, not a bad thing in and of itself at all. But I'll just read this one quote from one of the articles I read. Gratitude makes us feel more gratitude. So gratitude makes us feel more gratitude. This is why a 5-minute a day gratitude journal can make us so much happier. The actual gratitude produced during those 5 minutes is small, but the emotions of gratitude felt during those 5 minutes are enough to trigger a grateful mood. While in a grateful mood, we will feel gratitude more frequently, and when we do feel gratitude, it will be more intense and held for longer, and we will feel gratitude for more things at the same time. In 5 words, gratitude triggers positive feedback loops. So you can hear the language of technique here. It's all about these 5 minutes. It's all about the way in which you can manipulate your thinking into being happier. Everything is quantified with the goal of self-improvement. So this is what the technique of gratitude is very often reduced to. Fourthly, many gratitude techniques recommend spending time each day reflecting on the good things that have happened, while not allowing one's mind to dwell on the difficult things that have happened. So this is what a gratitude journal is. If you sat down at the end of the day with your gratitude journal, you would not include the parking ticket that you got. You would not include any number of other frustrating things that happened during the day. It's your gratitude journal. So the whole purpose is to intentionally remember those things that were good that happened throughout the day and not dwell too much on anything else. And so the question arises to me, does gratitude depend, within this notion of gratitude, does it depend on suppressing thoughts about painful experiences and instead only focusing on the positive things? Is it simply an exercise in shifting from a glass half empty to a glass half full mentality? And if so, if that is all it is, isn't there an element of pretense in it, or sentimentality even? Is gratitude something we can only conjure up if we heavily edit our own stories? If we gave all of our experiences equal thought, would gratitude be impossible? So in this framework, thankfulness is a potentially precarious thing, right? It's teetering. It could all come crashing down if things don't work out for me. It could all come crashing down if I think too much about how things are not working out for me. And I think this is the area where the biblical understanding of thankfulness really stands out as being something completely different. Biblical thankfulness is a very tough and resilient and robust thing that can grow and thrive in any circumstances. Not from ignoring the reality of pain at all. Actually, it grows from acknowledging the reality of pain. But it grows from a consciousness of the blessing of God that remains constant even in difficult circumstances. So biblical thankfulness looks at the worst that there is and still recognizes the good gifts of God in that, without pretending those bad things are unreal or not so bad after all, or an illusion or anything like that. The wonderful quote, I think, that expresses this from a man who, he passed away recently, but he used to be the Protestant chaplain at Harvard University named Peter Gomes. He has a book of sermons that have been transcribed, and this is a sermon on the Sunday before Thanksgiving, I don't know, 10 years ago or something like that. It was a while back. Anyway, so when he says this Thursday, he's referring to the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday. And he says, "This Thursday, as you gather around your tables with your dysfunctional families and friends, I invite you to remember not the usual good things, not the list of blessings you have received, but the bad things, by name, that have happened to you, the terrible things, the worst things. Think of your worst moments, your sorrows, your losses, your sadness, and then remember that you are here. And then remember that here you are, able to remember them. You got through the worst day of your life. There may be yet a worse one in store for you, but that's for next Thanksgiving. This Thanksgiving, you got through the trauma, you got through the trial, you endured the temptation, you survived the bad relationship. You're making your way out of the dark and out of the miry clay. Remember who got you through. If you remember to remember, you will remember, as the old spiritual says, how I got over. If I had time, I'd play that right now, a recording of that. But this is a robust understanding of thankfulness that does not depend on thinking fluffy pink thoughts, right? This is about relying on the goodness of God, the promises of God, what God has already done in your past, while looking directly at the hardship and the pain and the struggles and the failures. But it's only in that moment of honesty, really, that any sort of deep, robust thanksgiving can begin to develop in us. Because otherwise, there's always going to be some aspect of pretense. I'm thankful because I'm not looking at this. Next, the anatomy of gratitude. This is sort of a weird way of putting things. Every situation, big or small, in which a gift is given and thanks is returned is a transaction of sorts. And all I mean by anatomy is, what are the moving parts of that transaction? What are the components that have to be in place for gratitude to take place? And this is a fairly basic understanding of gratitude that many people in the West would share without maybe thinking about it very much. Maybe not. I may be wrong about that. But there's basically four parts that you can think of. There's a giver, and there's a gift, and there's a receiver, and there's a response. And the response is obviously what we would call gratitude or thanksgiving. But the response would be meaningless if not for these other parts. I want to look at what these other parts are. And so for the sake of argument, I'm going to take a scenario. My daughter draws me a picture and gives it to me, and I say, thank you. That's it. That's the scenario. So we have the giver, which is my daughter. There's the drawing, which is the gift. There's the receiver, which is me. And there's the response, thank you. It's the simplest one I could think of. It is simple, but each part of this little transaction is actually rich with implications. And the more so when you think about bigger scenarios in which Thanksgiving takes place. But it's rich with implications. First of all, the giver. Let's think about the giver. In order for gratitude to make sense at all, the giver must give with intention, not randomly or by accident. So if my daughter dropped the picture by accident as she was walking by me and didn't see that she dropped it, it wouldn't be a gift, right? In that context, it would be out of place to say thank you. So I say thank you because I know that she intended it for me and worked on it with me in mind. She thought of it as something to benefit me, and it cost her something. Not very much, maybe a few minutes of work, but it cost her something. And all this implies that there is a will at work in the giver. Intention. Which means that the giver has to be a person. Only a someone gives gifts. Only a someone is worthy of receiving thanks. You can't really make sense of the whole scenario if the giver of the gift is a something. Only a someone can give a gift. In addition, the giver will have to give gratuitously, not from obligation. For the drawing to be a gift, it has to be gratuitous. It has to be, in a sense, unnecessary. The drawing was not required of her. If my daughter had to give me a picture for some strange reason, I don't know, you know, what that reason would be. Say if I paid her in advance, I might still say thank you from politeness when she gives me the drawing, but I don't have to say thank you because it's not a gift. it's my due. I paid for it. She owes me a picture now, right? So if there's a sense of obligation there. To clarify, depending on the situation, the gift, it might be totally necessary to me, the receiver. I may be starving and someone welcomes me into their home and gives me food, and this gift is necessary to me if I'm going to survive. But from the perspective of the giver, the gift is not necessary. They didn't have to do it, right? There's a gratuitous aspect to it. They weren't obligated to open the door to me. Lastly, my daughter, if giving me the picture, must also give the picture freely, not in order to receive something back. If she only gave me a picture because she knows that I just bought a big bag of M&Ms, and she knows that they're in my pocket, and she knows from experience that if she behaves really sweetly, good things come to her. This would also muddy the water of gratitude, wouldn't it? I would say that for a gift to be worthy of thanks, it should be given from a desire for my well-being or enjoyment in some way, not simply as a tool to manipulate something out of me. If I feel obligated to return a favor, I'm less sure that I've received a gift. I think most of us have probably experienced this kind of thing. We receive something good from somebody, but yet we feel now we're bound in some way. Was that a gift or not? I don't know. And I think, again, like I said, most modern Westerners would probably agree with this perspective. If there's a whole bunch of strings attached to a gift, is it a gift? This is not actually a universal attitude towards gratitude that I just described. This is, I think, a modern Western assumption, but it's not the way people have viewed it throughout history. We'll see that a little later. What about the receiver? If I am to express gratitude, I'm going to recognize that I have received goodness. The goodness came from outside myself, and this takes a measure of humility, like I said before, because I'm acknowledging that someone else met a need that I did not supply myself. If I were to take credit for my daughter's drawing and say that it was really something that I did and it was unnecessary for her to have given anything, then I wouldn't say thank you to her. I have to recognize that goodness came from outside myself somehow. Dr. Robert Emmons, the guy I quoted earlier, who wrote this book, he says, let's see if I have this here. The object of gratitude is other directed. One can be grateful to other people, to God, to animals, but never to oneself. This is one significant way in which gratitude differs from other emotional dispositions. A person can be angry at himself, pleased with herself, proud of himself, or feel guilty about doing wrong, but it would be bizarre to say that a person felt grateful to herself. Thanks are directed outward to the giver of gifts. Helpful. That's insightful. finally, the last point there, the response. That's what we've been building up to, gratitude. For it to be gratitude, I'll have to acknowledge to the giver that I recognize the gift as a gift. If you ever given a gift to somebody that you really viewed as a gift and they received it as if it was just an entitlement. That's not Thanksgiving, right? So in order to be Thanksgiving, I have to acknowledge that the gift was a gift. This means to acknowledge that it is good. It means to acknowledge that the giver did not need to give it. My daughter could have spent her time doing something different, but she chose to draw me a picture. To say thanks is to reject a cynical interpretation of the events, actually. A cynical interpretation of the events might lead me to suspect that my daughter is just after the M&Ms. But if I say thank you, I'm assuming that that's not the case. I'm saying, no, my daughter gave this to me because she loves me. It was a genuine gift. So we tend to then praise the actions of the giver. The giver was good to do this. And that's all that is more or less implied when we respond gratefully to a gift. Or can be. So that's actually a lot going on in this very, very simple little transaction. When we say thanks and we mean it, there's a lot going on there. And there's a lot of criteria, it seems, for it being really gratitude. My point is basically this. The whole interaction is unavoidably relational and personal. It has to involve persons. A personal receiver who can say thanks and a personal giver who can give a gift on purpose. For any of this to make sense at all, the giver must be a person, someone capable of intention, someone capable of desiring the good of the other. Robert Emmons again, this is an article in the Journal of Social and Clinical Psychology. He describes gratitude as profoundly interpersonal, focusing us on the intentions of the benefactor. It's personal and it's about the intentions of the benefactor. And this does not change when we turn to the much larger context of our relationship to God. Gift and gratitude in our relationship to God, personhood is still the key. If you think of all the ways in which the interaction with my daughter wouldn't have made sense if it wasn't a person who gave the gift intentionally, well, exactly the same thing applies to our relationship to God. For gratitude to be real, for a gift to be a gift, there has to be a person. And we'll talk about that more later. I said that this basic understanding of gratitude is probably taken for granted by most people in the West, even if it's not articulated. I think this is only the case because of the residual impact of Christendom in the West. The Judeo-Christian tradition is what produced this understanding of gratitude. In the pre-Christian ancient world, my little anatomy of gratitude would have been a foreign concept and probably would have been ridiculed. So I want to look for a few minutes at something. It will seem like a little bit of a tangent, but I think it's been helpful to me in understanding actually the uniqueness of a biblical Christian picture of gift and gratitude. Borrowing heavily, or really just lifting heavily from this book called Gratitude and Intellectual History by Peter Lighthart. This is much more scholarly book. To me, it's a scholarly book. But very helpful, tracing the history of thinking on gratitude and gift. he argues that gratitude historically has been a very contested word. It's meant different things at different times. And he talks about gratitude in three basic categories. See if I can. Gratitude as circles, gratitude as lines, and gratitude as an infinite circle. And I'll try to explain what that means. So, first of all, gratitude as a circle. This is what he describes as being the view of gift and gratitude within much of the Roman and Greek world before Christianity came on the scene. And it continues in many traditional cultures today. When a gift is given, so you have giver up here, it sort of goes clockwise. Giver, gift, receiver, gratitude, and quote. So when a gift is given, gratitude is expected, but in the form of a return gift or favor in the future. So he's consciously expanded the meaning of gratitude to incorporate that as well. It's a response to a gift. What's the response to a gift? In this context, gratitude means a return gift or a favor in the future. So the proper expression of thanks was to give something tangible back. The giving of a gift always included a kind of obligation to respond in kind. To, in a sense, complete the circle. That's why he calls it a circle, right? The image of a circle is that it's not a circle unless it comes all the way back to the giver. This is actually, we have some very good friends that have spent a lot of time in Afghanistan, have lived there for many, many years, and I remember our friend Elliot saying this is actually the attitude among many people in Afghanistan towards gifts. If someone invites you over to dinner, it's nice, but in the context of that, as a very honor-based culture, you are then obligated to have them over to dinner to something equal or better. And so the word for this is reciprocity, and he uses it a lot. Lighthart uses it a lot in his book. Reciprocity. Within this framework, to receive a gift is in a sense a perilous thing, or potentially perilous thing, because there are very concrete strings attached. There's often some ambivalence in accepting a gift. Do I want to enter into a relationship of obligation with this particular person? He points out that, that Abraham, when he's offered help by the king of Sodom, rejects it because he doesn't want to enter into a relationship of obligation with the king of Sodom. He doesn't want later on the king of Sodom to say, Abraham is rich because of me. So, from the perspective of the giver, very often gifts were only bestowed in the ancient world to people who could actually do something for you in return. Someone who had something that you wanted, whose help you might value in the future. So you would not necessarily give a gift to someone who you knew could do nothing for you in return. And this concept of gratitude necessarily brings a aspect of calculation, of strategy, to every transaction of gift and thanks. We see it in the relationship between the patron and the client in the ancient world. When a person of higher standing gives gifts to someone of lower standing, and that person is obligated to really be loyal to them. And this is just a pattern that is all over the place in the ancient world, all over the place in the Bible as well. Leithart argues that circles of reciprocity were everywhere in the ancient world. They were the foundation of Greek and Roman society on a social level between people, social relationships. On a political level, favors were expected in return for favors, what today we would call corruption or cronyism, but was part of the political scene. And then on a religious level as well, that tight circle of reciprocity was projected onto the relationship between the gods and human beings as well. It was a quid pro quo kind of thing. The gods do something for you, you better do something back. This reciprocity was so taken for granted that when Jesus and Paul's teachings start to take off in the first century with a very different notion of what gift and gratitude are, the early Christians were perceived as promoting ingratitude. Similar in some ways to the fact that Christians were accused of being atheists because they only believed in one God, right? They refused to worship Caesar, they refused to worship the pantheon of Roman gods at the time, but they only worshiped the one. That earned them the title atheists. Well, in an analogous way, the early Christians were accused of promoting ingratitude because they had such a different notion of what gratitude was. I'm actually going to sort of skip over the gratitude as a line because it doesn't... it's even more of a tangent than I'm already on, so we're going to kind of skip that part and move on to what he says about the... that's the line, see? the infinite circle of Christian gratitude. So you have the gratitude as a circle, which we've just talked about, and then there's an infinite circle. The teaching of Jesus and Paul was radically, sort of a radical challenge to the surrounding culture. And Leithart describes what went on in the early church as an explosion of gratitude. And what does that mean? It's a very interesting argument. He said there's still reciprocity. So there's still this idea of return. But it's not the tight quid pro quo kind of reciprocity that was the norm between people in the ancient world. The giver gives a gift, the receiver better give something back. It's different than that. This is because the infinite God of the universe is now included in the circle, and so the tight little circle is now opened up infinitely. And what does he mean by that? If I am the potential giver of a gift, if I'm considering giving a gift to somebody, I have to, if I'm a Christian, first and foremost acknowledge that everything I have comes from God. Any gift I give to another person is, in a sense, re-gifting. I can give nothing that wasn't already provided for me by the infinite personal God, who has every right to redirect my resources how he sees fit. This is actually the moving thing to me. That being in La Brie, we're always somewhere near the precipice financially. And years ago, we were very low on money, and I've been praying about this, and there's a woman who had sort of out of the blue a very profound sense that she was supposed to give us money, and she did. But anyway, she followed this gift with an email in which she talked about having resources, but the Holy Spirit directs the flow. Mm-hmm. And that was a powerful thing. It stuck in, just that line stuck in my head as a particularly radical thing to say as a wealthy person in the world today, right? The Holy Spirit directs the flow. Obviously, as we consider in prayer what to do with our resources. But So the circle is opened up. It's opened up to the infinite giver of gifts. So if I'm considering giving something to somebody else, I have to acknowledge what I have to give is God's. So it's not mine in any ultimate sense. This frees me up to actually be free with what I have. If what I have is really God's, then I do not need to demand a return gift from that person. But here, Lightheart makes, I think, his most interesting observation. He says, there's still reciprocity because the infinite God steps in to the transaction and promises to bless those who give to the needy. The needy cannot repay you. Don't expect them to, but God will repay you. And so there's still reciprocity, but it's God entering into the circle and widening it to infinity. And there's a strong biblical emphasis on giving specifically to people who you know cannot pay you back. This is something that in the Gospel of Luke, he emphasizes. This is Luke 14:12. Then Jesus said to his host, when you give a luncheon or dinner, do not invite your friends, your brothers or sisters, your relatives, or your rich neighbors. If you do, they may invite you back, and so you will be repaid. So Jesus is talking into the culture at the time in which reciprocity is the assumption. You know, you'll be making them feel obligated and you'll be paid back. But when you give a banquet, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed. Although they cannot repay you, you will be repaid at the resurrection of the righteous. So, in a sense, God himself is in the business of compensating the giver for their generosity. And the receiver of the gift is off the hook, in a sense, in terms of a quid pro quo, receiving in like kind. Earlier in the Gospel of Luke, in Luke 6, he says, give and it will be given to you, a good measure pressed down, shaken together and running over will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. And it's talking about measured to you by God. It's not the measure you use, you will then be gifted back by people who you've helped. The measure you use in serving others will be measured to you by God. So if I am a receiver of a gift from another person, in this context of the infinite circle that he's describing, my first responsibility is to thank God from whom the gift has really come, and then to thank the generous person. Because every gift is a gift from God, even if it comes to us in a mediated way through the generosity of a person. I therefore am freed from the obligations of reciprocity, the expectation that I have to, if I receive a gift, I'm bound to return an equivalent favor. I am instead called to joyfully accept the gift, accept my status as a needy receiver, and give thanks to God. And then another aspect of the infinite circle, because we cannot possibly pay back God for the gifts he's given us, the emphasis of gratitude is then placed on how we use the gift. The reinvestment of God's gifts for the kingdom of God. We are blessed in order to bless others. If we have been the receiver, then perhaps by receiving, we've been equipped to be a giver. Right? And again, the circle is widened to the infinite because God has stepped into it. The infinite circle means that human givers and receivers are all in the position of receivers, if everything they have is from God. Interestingly, this exact same kind of model or structure applies. This is the very, very same spirit with which we're supposed to dole out forgiveness to people who have wronged us as well. If you think of the forgiveness as the gift, no matter how badly someone has treated me, if I forgive them, I'm doing nothing more heroic or costly than what has already been done for me through the atonement of Jesus Christ. So any forgiveness I give is a little reflection of the massive forgiveness I've received, right? And so this is actually one of the things that empowers forgiveness, knowing that we have been forgiven in ways that we cannot possibly fathom. So this is kind of a, to me, the Lightheart book helped me to see something unique about what the Christian faith teaches on gratitude. And I want to move to the last section here, which is just, is secular gratitude enough? A common question I think that Christians often ask is this. Without a belief in a God who loves us and who pledges to one day right everything that's wrong, how does a person cope with the grim realities of life? Say something really horrible happens. How does someone cope with the death of a loved one if they don't believe in the God who loves them and who will one day wrong every right? Right every wrong. Sorry. Ah, you're awake. Good. Excellent. It's a valid question. It's often a question that is, it's easily open to criticism, I think, by people who don't believe in God. One might say, just because it's painful to face life without the comfort of God doesn't mean that God must therefore exist. And actually, it is an inability to cope which has led to the invention of God, many would say. So it's a valid question, but open to criticism. But I'm actually trying to ask almost the opposite question tonight, which I think isn't asked as often. So this is something where, which I would love to believe is an apologetics opportunity, an opportunity to talk to people who do not believe in God. And the question is this: without a belief in God, the giver of every good and perfect gift, how does a person cope with the bountiful blessings of this life? How do they cope with the lingering feeling that somehow they've been blessed? Can people who do not believe in the God of the Bible adequately account for their own perception of having received gifts and their own desire to respond with thanks? Does their view of reality do justice to their desire to say thank you? And two particular questions I think that in my mind need to be answered. And I'm sure there's more, but these are just two that come to mind. From where does the desire to give thanks come? That's the bad sentence. There's two froms in there. Sorry. From where does the desire to give thanks come? So what's the source of it? Why is it in you? Why do you have a desire to give thanks? And the second question is, to whom can it realistically be directed? In other words, what's the object of thanksgiving? Who are you going to say it to? Can satisfying answers be found to these two questions without turning to the God of the Bible? That's the question that I want to take seriously. Now, obviously, given that our culture is a very entitled culture, not everyone has a deep and abiding desire to give thanks. So that's one caveat there. I would like to think that everybody actually does somewhere have a desire to give thanks. But it's obviously suppressed to different degrees in different people. But I can't prove that. But many people actually do, and have articulated it, that there's this desire to give thanks, and many of those people do not believe in a personal God at all. So what do we make of it? if you search online for atheist and gratitude, a lot comes up. One of the most repeated statements that you'll hear from self-professing atheists is that all necessary gratitude can be channeled towards the people that make a difference in the world and the people that make a difference in our lives. God is unnecessary, other people are sufficient object for our thanks. And it being Twitter, there was a lots of very short, little pithy statements. But there's a whole Twitter feed, secular gratitude, atheist thanks. And these are some of the comments that are on that. Atheists, agnostics, free thinkers, humanists, etc. express gratitude too. We just direct it towards people / forces which actually exist. Someone with a little, I don't know what you called it on Twitter, your little like title or whatever. It was godless and happy. Dear doctors, nurses, carers, therapists, social workers, medical researchers, you get us all through this life and make it better. Thank you. So that's coming from Godless and Happy. and this is from a press release. There's a press release talking about an advertisement that an organization called the Center for Inquiry had placed in Times Square, a massive big like screen that was projecting this video over and over again. So it was an advertisement around Thanksgiving time. And this is a quote from this press release. Since the non-religious don't believe in God, some wonder how we know who to give thanks to, said Ronald Lindsay. He's the president and CEO of the Center for Inquiry. Our answer is just to look around you at the people in your life, said Lindsay. We all have much to be grateful for this Thanksgiving, and millions of Americans, instead of praying to a God, will be expressing gratitude and love to those who do so much to make life worth living, their family, their friends, and those who help others in need. A supposed supreme being isn't necessary. So what do we make of all this? I think all these people are right to say that it's appropriate to say thank you to the people who make a difference to us and who are doing important things in the world. But to me, like all of these comments, and there's lots and lots of them, and my immediate reaction is, if we're honest, we'll see that there are many, many good things we receive every single day that's impossible to track back to another person. It's impossible to just assign that to another human being. In fact, none of the biggest and most basic necessities of life can possibly be bestowed by other people to us. G.K. Chesterton has this great quote where he says, when we were children, we were grateful to those who filled our stockings at Christmas time. Why are we not grateful to God for filling our stockings with legs? So, life itself, each breath, getting up in the morning, having legs, a measure of health, the use of our minds, the existence of beauty, our unique human ability to perceive it, whether it's in music or in literature or in the visual arts or in creation itself, the ability to perceive beauty and enjoy it. To me, this time of year, it's the subtle smell in the air that means springtime, and the warmth of the sun on my face, the sound of dripping water, and the feel of mud under my feet. These are all things that signify springtime in a way that appeals to all of my senses and is deeply moving and beautiful to me. What person do I thank for that? Most of what makes life possible and most of what makes life desirable seems to come to us from a mysterious origin, not from other people. That's not to discount all the good things that people do. I cannot thank my friends or my ancestors or aid workers for my life and my breath and the joy I experience at the coming of spring, or at the sight of a sunset. But these experiences of feeling blessed are real. My fear is that out of a commitment to not believe in God, many of the people who I was reading online feel forced to disregard the biggest and most basic blessings of life as not really gifts. They can't be accounted for, so they are discounted. One has to unrecognize life and breath as gifts, because to recognize them as gifts would be to come up against the question, gifts from who? And the answer is obviously not from my friends and family. So That's something that I feel is a corner that one backs into when one is an atheist. We have to either come up with a good answer for that or pretend that they're not gifts. But there's lots of other perspectives out there. I think an obvious one is that people who are very strict materialists want to turn to science as the source of all explanations. And not to explain the origin of life's mysterious gifts, because science doesn't, or at least certain aspects, certain view of science doesn't allow for mysterious gifts. But anyway, not to explain the origin of life's mysterious gifts, but to try to explain the origin of our desire to give thanks. Science can try to explain that to us. Why do we have this weird impulse to read gifts into the world out there? We know the world's impersonal. Why do we always read gifts into it and somehow feel this impulse to say thanks? Where does it really come from? And there's lots of things to say there. An article in the Atlantic Online magazine is written by Emma Green, and I'm just she's actually quoting somebody else here named Michael McCullough. she says, I forget whether I actually had a slide for this or not. Yes. I'll be reading this just in chunks. These are different excerpts from the same article. One of the things that's really interesting about the human mind is that we seem to want to see agency in the world, almost intuitively, says Michael McCullough, a psychologist at the University of Miami. The mind really craves an explanation for the good and the bad in terms of agency. He's basically saying, for some reason, the human mind looks out at the impersonal physical world, which is all there is, and desires to see intentionality, and so we see it. that's just something that seems to be hardwired into our brains. Between evolutionary biology and neuroscience, this question has been answered to many people's satisfaction. In other words, our brains are hardwired to produce gratitude, but as a result of millions of years of natural selection, which has made our brains that way. Gratitude provided some kind of reproductive advantage to people, and that's why we still see it today in ourselves. So the article goes on here, again quoting, McCullough thinks there's another reason for the ubiquity of gratitude. It's an evolutionary beneficial trait hardwired into the human brain. Even things that are culturally constructed have to have a home somewhere up in the mind to come out in our thoughts and our behavior, he said. Like all emotions, gratitude was plausibly designed by natural selection. There's some tissue up in the head whose job it is to produce gratitude. He's not actually a neuroscientist, so there are many neuroscientists who would wax eloquent about the details. He's not just making this up. But then he ends his quote with, "But I have my bets on there being an evolved circuitry, because of what it seems to be good at doing. It's pretty good at getting you to notice unexpected favors." So he's saying that basically our neuroscience, the neural firings in our brain, the structure of our brain, is really, really good at getting us to see gifts where there are none. Basically, we're really, really good at getting us to see intentionality and agency out there when really it's an impersonal world. So, does this put the matter to rest? I don't know. I have other questions. Because the desire to see agency in the world and to interpret so much of life as a gift, that's a desire, because it can be explained as just determined by our neural circuitry and produced by evolution, you know, and therefore the nagging question of to whom do we give thanks can be laid to rest. That's what's being said there, basically. We're just conditioned to think that way, so it doesn't correspond to any real giver, and so we don't have to worry about it. To some people, that is enough. And we can talk about that more in the discussion time. I'm not really going to offer much critique about that, not being an evolutionary biologist or a neuroscientist. But there are problems. It doesn't actually, the problem doesn't go away. Another perspective, this is from a guy named Ronald Aronson, an article I found, he teaches at Wayne State University in Detroit, and it's a really honest article. I appreciate it a lot. He's not a believer in any kind of God, as far as I can tell. The article is entitled, Thank Who Very Much. And he gets points for a clever title there. And I'm going to quote it at length, so just because I think he says a lot of things which are helpful and interesting. So bear with me here. Sorry if that's hard to read. He begins his article like this. This is Ronald Aronson. Hiking through a nearby woods on a late summer day, I followed the turning path and suddenly saw a pristine lake. Then I walked down a hill to its edge as birds chirped and darted about, stopping at a clearing to register the warmth of the sun against my face. Feelings welled up. Physical pleasure, delight in sounds and sights, gladness to be out here on this day. But something else as well, curious and less distinct, a vague feeling more like gratitude than anything else, but not toward any being or person I could recognize. Only half-formed, this feeling didn't fit into any easily discernible category, evading my usual lenses and language of perception. The one immediately available way of experiencing my incipient feeling begins with thanking God. For many, religion provides a ready stock of lenses and language to identify such experiences, because much of religion is about gratitude. Orthodox Jews, for example, thank God dozens of times a day, both in formal prayer and in common expressions, for the sunrise, for waking up alive, for food and drink, for going and coming safely, for every pleasure, great and small, for health, for completing the day's activities, for nightfall, for sleep. This way of relating to our lives and world has undeniable power. Thanking God out here on the trail would tie together everything I see and experience, direct me towards its source, and give me a personal relationship with that being. It would, moreover, unite my feeling of pleasure with my understanding, and fill me with a sense of gratitude that points towards my life's meaning and purpose. So this is him saying, if I believed in God, that's what it would do for me. So he's been quite honest. I appreciate this. However, he cannot accept the existence of God, but neither does he want to accept total nihilism. Neither does nihilism do justice to his experience of feeling somehow blessed, right? So Aronson is desperately looking for, in his own words, an alternative to thanking God on the one hand and seeing the universe as a cosmic lottery on the other. An alternative to being grateful to a deity or to ignoring such feelings altogether. So he wants to take seriously this sense that he's been blessed. But he does not want to thank God for it or acknowledge that there is a God. That's the point. And I like this guy. He's being honest, at least, about the difficulties that his atheism presents to him. And he refuses to dismiss or poo-poo his own response to the mysterious gifts. Even if that response is inexplicable to him, he doesn't write them off. But his conclusions are really unsatisfying to me, I find. And ultimately not all that different from all the Twitter comments that I read earlier. He argues that we need to become aware of what he calls our map of dependence, which is a vast network of people, cultural realities, historical events, and forces in nature on which we rely. For Aronson, acknowledging the epic scope of our dependence and accepting that we belong in this state of dependence is the key to authentic gratitude without God. In the end, Aronson, I think, simply expands the list of things to be thankful for to include the whole physical universe on which we depend completely, but he comes no closer to answering the questions, to whom can our gratitude be meaningfully directed? He never answers that question. He just makes the circle bigger and bigger of things that we can be thankful for. His anatomy of gratitude still has no personal giver. It has no coherent object at all, actually, for our gratitude to point to. And then, this is the last little chunk here, sorry. This is near the end of his article. And if we fully live our belonging, if we live this sense of our dependence, if we acknowledge it and live into it, it is just possible that we will often feel connected in these various ways and often grateful. Feelings of dependence and belonging are appropriate attitudes of response for the secular person. So are feelings of reverence and awe. None of these need be vague or fuzzy if their worldly sources are not ignored and they are not projected beyond our universe. They become specific modes of living and experiencing our actual situation. When we gather with friends and family for a holiday, feelings of gratitude come spontaneously. A warm, joyous, comfortable feeling, even a moment of well-being. We are grateful, but to whom or what? Obviously, to natural forces and processes that have made our life and this reunion possible. Less obviously, to our ancestors, distant and recent, and their struggles. And perhaps even less obviously, to other people's labor, which has helped to set the table at which we feast and rejoice. Gratitude, when it is clear-eyed, acknowledges some part of the fullness of our dependency. So, he's expanding the, like I said, the number of things to be thankful for to include, you know, the whole universe. But he's still standing in the same place, I think. In the absence of a grand supernatural giver, Ronald Aronson directs his desire to give thanks to the gifts themselves, as if the gifts are the giver. The gifts of life and dependence become the object to which he says thank you. In order to do justice to his profound feelings of reverence that he has without an infinite God, he expands this understanding of the gift to be as close to infinite as possible. He wants to make it bigger and bigger to sort of, I think, justify the weight and the reverence that he feels. But it's still not a personal giver. But really, I mean, it's almost a perfect articulation of what idolatry is in the end. To look to the gifts as if they were the giver, right? The gifts of God are good, but they are unable to take the place of the one who gave them. Gifts cannot make themselves, and gifts cannot give themselves. So we come again, back again and again, into the necessity of personhood, a personal giver. And so I want to stop and just talk about that a little bit. Many of the people we've been talking about take issue with this idea of the personhood of God, the personal God. Belief in a personal God is often dismissed as a mere projection of human personhood onto an impersonal cosmos. So it's a sort of a wish fulfillment, they argue. The world is a harsh place and people can't bear the meaninglessness of it. And so we invent this idea that there is a personal God who is like us, bigger and better than us, maybe, who can look down on us, look out for us, and give our lives meaning. So we're projecting our own understanding of personhood onto the blank universe in order to make a God who is personal. In a sense, we are creating God in our own image. There's nobody out there, but we're people, and so we project a person into the sky. His personhood is derived from our personhood, and we do this to cope in what would otherwise be a world that's too painful and meaningless. And this is a very common attitude, I think, towards religion. Religion as a cultural construction. Of course, the Bible claims that just the opposite is true. It's almost precisely the opposite. God has always been a person. At the very heart of reality, the very heart of reality is personhood. And our personhood is derived from His, because He made us in His image. The Bible reveals God as a personal being. He's not a human person, but He is the source of human personhood. He's also infinite. This means that He's in no way contained by the universe that He made. There's no limit to His power and His knowledge and His goodness and His lordship. He's utterly other and apart from His creation, even though He's intimately involved with it. But none of these things make him less a person. He's capable of relationship. There has actually always been relationship within the Trinity itself. So there's relationship within God, and always has been, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. God can know us and be known by us. He can communicate meaningfully. He has a will. He has desires. He has loves. He sees. He cares. He makes promises. And because he made us persons, we can talk to him. We can ask him for things. We can say thank you to him. Without God being personal, nothing the Bible teaches makes any sense at all. So we're kidding ourselves if we think the personhood of God is insignificant. We couldn't say any of these things if we were pantheists. Pantheism is essentially this belief that there's one divine substance. There's a unity of all things. God is everything, and everything is God. You can't have a personal God and be a pantheist at the same time. Interesting. Anybody remember the movie Avatar? It was a while back now. But that's something that movie tried to have both, I think. It was essentially a picture of a pantheistic reality that everything is connected, everything is one. The deity is the planet and everything on it. And yet, in this crucial turning point in the story, the main character prays to this god and his prayer is answered. It's instead of wanting to have its cake and eat it too, you want to have this really cool sort of pantheistic notion of everything being one, but you also, when you're in trouble, want to talk to a person. Right? So, anyway. The comfort that Christians have from believing in the personhood of God is not a result of naive wish fulfillment, I don't think. It's actually a challenging and uncomfortable thing sometimes. Rather, it's the result of connecting with the one whom we were made to know and serve and enjoy forever. So we're coming into contact with our deepest purpose when we're comforted by the personhood of God. Because we were made to connect with God, this connection is the only way in which we can ultimately thrive as human beings. And so it makes all the sense in the world that it would be a comfort to me to believe in this God. And it makes all the sense in the world that people, no matter what they believe about God, have some deep, hard to account for, desire to say thank you. Thank you is what we were made to say. It's one of the things we were made for, is to say thank you. And so, lo and behold, many people who have no belief or interest in God find themselves wanting to say thank you. People who convert to Christianity very often experience a deep joy that their new belief allows them to say thank you to someone in a way that they haven't been allowed to say before. I say people. G.K. Chesterton articulates this. My mom has articulated this. That's two. Surely there's others, you know. There's someone to thank. You can thank him for everything good that you've ever experienced. Chesterton says, another quote from him, "You say grace before meals? All right. But I say grace before the concert and the opera, and grace before the play and the pantomime, and grace before I open a book, and grace before sketching, painting, swimming, fencing, boxing, walking, playing, dancing, and grace before I dip the pen in the ink." It's funny to picture him doing all those things, because he's this huge guy. Anyway, but in any case, fencing. But I love that, though, because he's saying that, you know, when we believe in the God who's the giver of all good things, suddenly all this stuff is gift now in a way that it wasn't before to me before I believed in God, right? And I can actually acknowledge it and praise God who gave me these things. And there's no end to it. I don't have to be satisfied with thanking the Son, which doesn't know me, and would just as soon kill me, you know, if I was stranded in the desert, right? The Son is impersonal. So I don't have to somehow thank abstract forces in the world that I do depend on as a human being, but that are not persons. I can say thank you to the one who made the Son, the one who commands gravity, the one who commands the sun to warm the earth, and yet, wonder of wonders, knows me and cares for me. This is something about something like this is in Psalm 8, where David talks about looking up at the heavens and being astonished, given the scope and grandeur of the heavens, that God is mindful of him, a human being. And he can say thank you to God for what he's made. So I want to just move on to my conclusion here. The approach tonight has not at all been to say, as a non-Christian, you cannot possibly be grateful, so come into the light so you can now be grateful. That's not at all what I'm trying to say. Rather, the question is, I think that we as Christians can ask people who we know who aren't believers, why are you as grateful as you are? And on what grounds are you grateful? And to whom is that directed? I want to believe that there is a universal impulse in all human beings to give thanks, that there's this deep desire in all of us, because we're made in the image of God, to say thank you. Again, I don't know, I can't prove that. but I want to suggest that part of that sense of longing that we sometimes have is a desire to respond appropriately. And maybe we don't always know how. And part of responding appropriately to what is feels like a gift is actually a desire to say thank you. How do we respond to it? And thanks is the response. So I think that because we can't help but feel, even if we have no religious sort of belief or theology to place it, that there's something personal about the world. Even if it's people attempt to explain it away through neuroscience, we're still left with that experience, that consciousness, that somehow there's something personal and gifted about the world. There's something personal about the sunset. There's something personal about the coming of spring. There's intention and agency somehow in it. And I think all kinds of people sense that, not just people who have a theology to as a foundation. People feel like they're receiving something like a gift, even if they don't really believe in anyone who might be the giver. But this feeling, while it poses a problem for them, I think is actually one of the best points of contact with reality that they may have. And so all that is to say, I think we need to have more conversations about gratitude with people who aren't believers in God and see where they go, see where the conversations go. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say. any questions or comments? We always have a time of discussion here, but if you need to leave, you can leave whenever you need to.
One thing that's thrown out there that probably was implied mm-hmm. when we were comparing Thanksgiving to gratitude or mm-hmm. thanksgiving mm-hmm. Was that, if I'm understanding you correctly, gratitude would be an emotion, mm-hmm. whereas thanksgiving wouldn't be an emotion, it would be an act. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like what we're talking about, and what I certainly believe, is that we're talking about an act versus the emotion that might lead mm-hmm. to an act.
Yeah, I think... I'm not... Gratitude might be more than just an emotion. I'm trying to think, but yeah, it exists in emotion, as an emotional category. I think yeah,
so
it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, with that about yeah. Is gratitude an emotion?
Yeah,
and it's in some ways it's a little bit different for me mm-hmm. As the way I classify other emotions.
Yeah,
especially if you feel like you can have gratitude.
Yeah,
if you do, it's a little bit different than. Having happiness.
Yeah.
It's very different.
I think one of the things that makes it different from other emotional states is that is what the guy Robert Emmons observed, is that it is an emotional state, but that it's intrinsically other oriented. So it's not you cannot be grateful to yourself in any meaningful way. but you can be angry at yourself, and you can be pleased with yourself, and you can be happy with yourself, and all these other things. But it's still an internal emotional state, but it's different. It's a different kind of thing.
Sure.
I think to me that may be the main difference. Did you have it?
Some of that very much really. It seems to me that gratitude itself, even unexpressed, more than most emotions, is a recognition of something. It's a conscious sort of cognitive recognition of something being the case.
Mm-hmm.
Good grief. I owe this to so-and-so, something like
mm-hmm.
that. And it's a recognition of a state of affairs. It's a conviction.
Right.
Whether I express it or not.
Mm-hmm.
More than, I feel happy today.
Which is just experience.
The struggle in thinking about gratitude as an emotion, that was actually worded very well, because emotions themselves, you feel them. That's what there is to it, as much as I'm not trying to make emotions sound less than they are.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all there is to it. It's an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there's inherently a lot more to gratitude than just the emotion.
Yeah.
So it seems.
Yeah. Maybe it's unhelpful to call it an emotion. I don't know. I think the distinction I was trying to make was that gratitude, by definition, does not have to be expressed. It can be something that you acknowledge inside, and don't say.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can be expressed.
Yeah.
But the distinction is Thanksgiving, if it's going to be Thanksgiving, by definition, is expressed. You're giving it.
And you actually didn't even draw the comparison to it as emotion.
Yeah.
You actually, one of the callous lines, like all emotions, gratitude was possibly designed by natural selection.
Mm-hmm.
That line kind of stuck out.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
I need to question that.
Yeah.
I haven't thought of gratitude as an emotion until...
Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, after this, the last 5 minutes, I'm uncomfortable calling it an emotion in any simple way. Yeah.
Yeah. Just thinking about that, though, I want to say that I think Thanksgiving, in the fullest sense, I think it's kind of like love that has.
Yeah.
You know, the Bible talks about love in different ways, but it starts as an action, not with your emotion. You're commanded to love whether you feel like or not, and that actually includes action.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Give your neighbor a coat, whatever. But the fullness of love grows to include as you do that, and I think that the picture of what we should move toward and what we will and what God will help us move toward and which forever we will have is includes fullness. And so Thanksgiving as well, I think as we practice thankfulness, which means maybe saying thank you to someone including God, where we don't necessarily feel it, it grows to expand, to include feelings, emotions.
Yeah.
So it's not just limited. It's not just cognitive. It's not just this I know.
Yeah.
The fullness of it should really become our whole
being. Yeah. I think that's helpful because I think the. I sort of want to say that gratitude unexpressed is incomplete. It's great to realize and be convicted that we've received something. That's a good thing. But it's also meant to lead to expressing that. So thanksgiving is not the ideal. but that being said, I think particularly you see this with grown-ups, but also with little kids, too, when you want them to say thank you, because it's important for them to learn how to say thank you and to recognize when they've received a gift. But you have no idea whether they're genuinely feeling warm gratitude in their hearts when they say thank you. But that's okay. They still have to say thank you. And the hope is that over years of training and hopefully good parenting in other ways, they will grow into people who both can say thank you, but also know that they've been given gifts. And so, the hope, the ideal, the future is a total coherence between internal life and outward life, outward words and actions, even though for the time being, sometimes we have to just say thank you, even if we don't feel feel it strongly. Any other thoughts? Do you?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I as you were talking, I kind of made the analogy of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much anything in creation is receiving light from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Things at the bottom of the sea, mm-hmm. That's a good part of it. And I was also kind of thinking about, and I don't know the reference for this, that God has termed the Father of Light, and just kind of bringing that into the equation. And I really liked the way you talked about Avatar, and I think that's a great kind of way to talk with folks who have a vague idea of God or don't believe in God,
mm-hmm.
kind of question. Because those types of pantheistic or idolatrous ideas are very current
mm-hmm.
in many, many people's thought processes.
Definitely.
I think that's a great way to kind of dissect what's actually going on in one's head. Because
yeah.
I think with the pluralistic society we live in, it's easy for them to assume that their gratitude equals the way our gratitude functions.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's worth having those types of conversations to help them kind of see the differences.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that's true. In a sense, this is the as I was working on this, I realized that the whole no interest in scoring points off of anybody. What I keep coming back to again and again is like the conversations that we need to have with people are getting them to articulate what they think and why.
Yeah.
That's all. Basically, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, and obviously maybe pressing some points about you know, what do you do with gratitude in the impersonal mm-hmm. world mm-hmm. For the things that you can't just thank a person for? Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts? Yeah, my friends.
You may not even want to respond to this. This is a little bit off subject, but when you were talking about like the idea of like a gratitude journal or at the end of the day, I was thinking about something that is not part of my background that I've been exploring a little bit is the prayer of examine,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which to my very limited understanding is really the practice at the end of the day
mm-hmm.
of acknowledging both what you're most grateful for, but also there's two pieces to it, but also what you're not grateful for.
Yeah.
It's not always phrased necessarily around gratitude. Just,
mm-hmm.
When did you feel the most love? When did you feel the least love? Or when did you feel closest to God during the day? When did you feel closest from God during the day?
Yeah.
Sort of a reflective piece that's sort of both sides of that. I don't know. I just didn't know if you had any thoughts on that.
I don't know a whole lot about it, although I've Sarah Chestnut has talked to me, has mentioned that also to me as being it's a way of sort of at the end of the day, in a time of quiet, taking note of the good and the bad. which sounds very wise to me.
I think the point of it is not necessarily Thanksgiving for the sake of Thanksgiving. I think the point of it is to see God.
Yeah.
to recognize the place of God in your day or in your life. But I thought of that when you were talking about the idea of the gratitude journal
mm-hmm.
and how that can be a good thing and a helpful thing. It's been a very helpful thing for me at different points, but
mm-hmm.
but how there's not necessarily space built in there and then to look at the difficult things too and even that idea of like we don't give thanks for all things but in all things we do and anyway, I just wondering if
I feel like gratitude journal is a good thing to write to keep in parallel with a prayer journal for the things that you're crying out to God about, so that you can look back in your prayer journal and see the ways in which prayers have been answered, maybe. And then to remember that is key. Like remember, it's like we were talking last week with Marta on the whole lecture on memory and. Connection of thankfulness to memory is so crucial. Like if we don't really remember too well all the stuff we cried out to God about, particularly when the problems go away, then we are crippling ourselves in terms of our ability to to say thank you to God. Yeah.
Yeah, there's something in the prayer to examine that for me was like sort of having the freedom to acknowledge something I'm not grateful for, or sort of in the freedom to acknowledge those things that I think makes me more able to express thanksgiving somehow.
Yeah. Yeah, right.
I was just thinking, just thoughts are kind of connected, but I was in a yoga class a few years ago, and we were doing the sun salutation, and it was this was in the basement of a Catholic church, and a lot of the women who went there were Catholic, and so, you know, believing in God, and so I just heard her too many times. Now we worship you, O sun. So I just said, excuse me.
Oh, did you really?
Do you mind if we just say we greet you, O sun? I'm a Christian. I think probably the other Christians are too. And I believe the sun was created. It's part of creation. So we don't worship the sun. And she said, oh, fine. That's fine. That's fine. So from then on, we greeted the sun. We didn't worship the sun. But
your intolerance was met with tolerance.
For all of us. Anyway, but I was sort of shocked that nobody else, even though I know this, because I heard them talk all the time. This is the church they went to.
Right, yeah. Interesting.
I hope maybe some of them thought a little about that. But
some of them were probably grateful that you said something.
Well, maybe. I don't know. But then, just the other thing which really hit me when you were talking about the anatomy of the gift, the giver, the receiver, and the response. It just really hit me hard because I participated in a stress reduction clinic that was started by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is a practicing Buddhist and an MD, and it's a conscious marriage of Eastern meditation and Western medicine. And after doing that course, I read two of his books because I was really trying to think of where's overlap with Christian faith and where's it different. He has a thing called generosity meditation, and it was really powerful in the book because he's saying in generosity meditation, you meditate feelings of generosity toward other people, toward all sorts of things, but it's contemplating, meditating feelings of generosity. He says, you don't have to give anything away. You don't have to give everything away or even anything away because what you want to do is just really notice what it's doing for you because at the deepest level, the gift, the giver, and the recipient are simply the universe rearranging itself.
Yeah.
They're not.
There's no distinction.
There's no distinction between the gift, the giver, and the recipient. And it's just, whoa, what a difference between the Christian faith, which says the gift and the giver are both recipients of grace and every good thing they have from what you said so well. The one who has to give is just as dependent on their receiving with their
You can see how that just meditate on internal feelings of generosity just meshes so nicely with totally materialistic culture. I mean, this is why some of this stuff really people in the West eat it up, because it's. I mean, to me that's like, wow, great. I can focus on myself, on coming to this place of inner peace, and I don't have to give anything to anybody. It's all about my internal.
Isn't that what James was talking about in the second chapter?
Yes. Go be fed. Go and
feed. Don't give them any food. And yet, you know, this guy, John Kabat-Zinn, actually is a very loving, generous.
Right,
Totally. You know, he is not. He really believes this philosophy.
Yeah.
He totally believes that monism, everything's one. And so this is going to help you live happily in the world. But it just hit me so hard, the difference between. There is a difference.
Yeah.
I see, Marty, and a lot of people wouldn't be able to see the distinction. You know, could see that, but an awful lot of people. Operization, random acts of kindness.
Anybody else? Joe,
going back to the idea of
the discussion about the gratitude journal.
Yeah.
Today is the first day I've ever heard of a gratitude journal. And as such, I don't know about too many of the thoughts going into what makes a good gratitude journal, and if anybody's had different ideas about them. But mm-hmm. you know, when you were talking about the concept of a gratitude journal being based on good things mm-hmm. to be thankful for, the happy things,
mm-hmm.
And kind of maybe turning a blind eye towards mm-hmm. the difficult, the hardship, the traumatic, what have you. You know, I think I might actually start keeping the gratitude mm-hmm. journal. The gratitude journal I would keep just as a tool in my day to just practice gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably part of that I would make sure to include something happy, good that mm-hmm. I'm thankful for, but also, and I believe that there's some sort of hardship and difficulty mm-hmm. in every day
mm-hmm.
to be thankful for also, mm-hmm. and to include something of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I have to confess, I have never kept a gratitude journal, so I feel, I don't have a lot to say practically, but to me, I want to acknowledge the fact that a lot of people may have a much more nuanced approach to gratitude journals than the one I described here, which is basically just write about some happy stuff because it's about focusing on the good, sort of the power of positive thinking. Don't get bogged down on the stuff that was a drag today, because that's not going to yield the desired result of happiness. That may be I think unfair in some cases because I think the more thoughtful approach is more like what you're saying, which is to acknowledge something of the range of experiences of the day, and I think to me there's very often at the end of the day there's stuff that happens that I can't account for and I can't that I know is hard and is bad in some way that may at some point be revealed to have been really helpful. Whether something good may come out of it, but it doesn't mean that thing was therefore good. And so, to me, I mean, as a Christian, I want to be able to distinguish between I want to be able to thank God for the good things, and I don't think I'm obligated to thank God for what is bad that He Himself grieves. And yet, I want to have faith that He's able to bring good things out of those bad things, and some of those things are what we can be most thankful for. Anyway, that's kind of garbled, but
I think I've tried to keep a gratitude journal, not terribly successfully.
Did you call it that? Did you think of it that way, or just a journal?
Oh yes.
Okay.
It's a little book, black book.
Oh.
Did it say gratitude journal on the cover?
Yeah.
I bought it completely blank. But I think it may have to do with temperament
mm-hmm. a bit,
because I have no problem remembering bad things and things to worry about.
You don't have to write those down.
I don't have to write those down. But things, that's done.
Yeah, don't have to worry about it anymore. Yeah.
And there's so much in the Psalms, particularly if God did this, but they forgot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And God did this, and the other thing, but they forgot that too.
Yeah.
And we just go on, and so that may have to do with our sort of the occupational hazard of being yourself,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. whatever that may mean,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
and what's most helpful. I found it some help, and mm-hmm. I'm very good at keeping up with it, but I do.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while.
Another way to put it for me might also be not so much something good that I'm thankful for and something bad that I'm thankful for, but maybe a success in my day and a failure,
mm-hmm.
shortcoming in some way,
mm-hmm.
and thanking for that because there's something to be learned from
mm-hmm.
both of those.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what we're
mm-hmm.
talking about.
Yeah, and that I mean, I, my
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm trying to think if I decide to start keeping a prayer journal. Gosh, or write the gratitude journal. It's almost like, yeah. To me, I would frame that, the thing you just described, to me, I would frame it as what I'm grateful for and what I need to pray for. God made this difficult thing somehow make good come out of it. Because I don't always know. Or am I unable to see the potential good?
I think I just want to agree with Dick, because I what he said really resonates with me. And again, I've done gratitude journal not consistently. Mine's bright yellow. Maybe that helps. But I was quite intentional about starting it, because I recognized that this was an area in my life I didn't feel like a very grateful person in general, and I wasn't. I mean, I was grateful somebody gave me something physical in my hands, but and I think that there are people. I mean, I can think of a few right now. I know who I feel like, for whom gratitude in a way is a gift. That kind of, as they move through their day, there is a very active recognition and sometimes verbalization of those things. I am not that person, and I think I felt like, this is a space, this is something, as you say, Ben, there's a very strong biblical mandate for gratitude, and I felt like that's something I needed to actively cultivate in myself, and that was a sort of a tangible way to do it.
Definitely.
I don't know that that's necessary for everybody.
Yeah, I think maybe it does come naturally to more naturally to some people than others, which is a matter of their temperament, and it's a gift, I would say, but a gift that we're all supposed to cultivate what we have, so that our gratitude would correspond to reality, because it's about corresponding to reality. It's not a tool to achieve some heightened health, you know, whatever. It's attempting to bring our wayward minds into line with what's true, and that's what it
the
is.
The reality of God and the reality of God's presence in our day and our life and the world.
Yeah.
To see that.
Yeah. It's also just, even when it doesn't come naturally, it's a matter of obedience. Numerous times where it says remember or give thanks.
Yeah.
Like, plenty more than once. But
more than, I'm pretty sure it's more than once.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
Whatever the number is. But
yeah.
It's God knows it doesn't come naturally to us, so I think He knew to put it in there hundreds of times.
Yeah. That's true. If the word remember is there enough so that you think, well, God knows that we forget, so that's why it's there. I think maybe I will, unless you have one more.
Totally quick. It's just, I was thinking of the total opposite of a thankfulness or gratefulness journal. When we lived in England, in a church meeting in our house, Dick met with this woman, counseled this woman. I don't remember where you met her. And he came back, he was just...
I was a counselor, I went to visit her.
Oh, you went to visit her.
She was not to be counseled.
But he came back really shaken, because this woman had a stack of papers that high of basically all of her grievances in life. Her whole life was consumed with her grievances. All
the ways in which people had wronged her.
Let her down, disappointed her, all the ways in which life had just cursed her. You know? And she was an utterly miserable person.
Of course.
This is where the psychology side
started.
You're right, you know?
Yeah. that's something like, I don't want to condescend to this notion that, what am I trying to say? There is such a thing as choosing to dwell on the good things, which is not just avoiding the ugly. As long as it's not a, I'm not sure what the distinction is there, but I know there is such a thing as dwelling on the ugly and therefore becoming completely embittered. So it doesn't matter where we choose to let our minds go again and again. It reminded me of this
that stack of papers of all your grievances of the part of Till We Have Faces, where the main character brings her grievance to the gods, which is, you know, her this litany of every way in which they have destroyed her and taken away everything that's precious to her, and she finally, in this sort of dreamlike state, finally gets her chance, like, to present, and there's nothing in her head. Like, she doesn't, this book, this volume she's been working on her whole life, basically, is, I forget the details, but it falls apart in her hand. There's nothing to it, it's insubstantial, she has nothing to say. And she's basically silenced.
Well, it's different from what, I mean, you've done some really helpful work on lamentation, just a very different thing.
Yeah.
The honesty of lamentation, which is kind of overlaps. Mm-hmm. You know, our bringing our sorrows and sadness and why, oh God, why, Lord, mm-hmm. that's there in Scripture, but that's different from this attitude of entitled grievances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Okay, so
yeah, Jeff,
final comment.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking of the last quotes you had there were just absolutely heartbreaking. Mm. It was just on a pure emotional level to read that.
Yeah.
To see all of this beauty and to not have the response.
Mm-hmm.
You want it to kind of culminate in this response of, you know, praise or thanksgiving. Wow, like there is something more. You know?
Yeah.
Just, I don't know.
No, I felt the same way. The same way. There's a... the consummation of all this should be worshipped, right? and he sort of, this guy seems to recognize that and then be like, whoa, no. to think, and a lot of what he says is very helpful, to think more deeply about all the aspects of interdependence that make our life possible. We are dependent on someone else who grew this food somewhere else, and we're dependent on someone shipping it across the country, and we're dependent on an economy that works, and we're dependent on people who fix roads. And yes. I don't want to say as a Christian, I don't want to say no. We just thank God. You know, all the things that these various different atheists are pointing to as that this is good enough. We just thank people. And I'm not in any way wanting to dismiss what they're saying. Like, yes, but is that the sum total of what we have to say thank you for? No way.
There's also a very big difference between being thankful and appreciating.
Hmm.
I don't think appreciation has come up in this talk yet, mm-hmm. but you can appreciate something that you wouldn't be right to thank for.
Can you give an example of what you mean by that?
I felt like actually the... maybe I'm not sure about that part. Thinking of the roads, you know, going down the roads, you get all these potholes, and the next day I go down the roads, they've all been fixed.
That must be really nice.
Being an appreciation, you don't necessarily need a person to be an object of appreciation.
Right. Right.
You can appreciate the sun.
You can just enjoy the experience of having received it. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, with gratitude. You're absolutely right. Mm. It's a person oriented thing. And where's the block on that? It's really, there is really a way in which we don't want to acknowledge that. We don't want to admit dependency. I just think of the nine leopards going off toward Jerusalem.
Yeah.
I can't believe they weren't happy.
Yeah.
Of course they were happy. They'd just been healed from leprosy, apparently.
Yeah.
And they were probably joking, slapping each other, but like wondering what the priest's going to say. They'd probably never seen anybody cured from leprosy.
Yeah, yeah.
And all this stuff. But that didn't make any one of them grateful, or only one of them was grateful. All the nine kept going, laughing, joking, all the way to Jerusalem.
They were now able to be part of the community again. Like the impact of, But
And we look at that and we say, that's ridiculous, they should have gone back. And yet, I don't think we feel anything like the same thing with God.
Yeah.
You know, people read Romans 1. Mm-hmm. You know, the invisible power and deity of God, all this stuff, but they were, and then it says, they refused to give thanks,
mm-hmm.
to honor him or give thanks to him. It sounds as fun as Dragon Easy referencing that. And we think, good grief, this seems an overreaction of God to take so seriously that he's not thanked.
Yeah.
Not honored. And this is God egotistical. Because that's a huge, you know, as you were saying, it's a huge reality of what sin means.
The gravity of not being grateful.
And yet we can relate to it in when we see someone heals someone and they don't even go back and say, but we don't. It's harder, I think, to relate to it with God, maybe because it's so all-encompassing.
Yeah.
And but it totally challenges our sense of who we are, our sense of our own independence, our own autonomy, our own self-sufficiency. But that's a huge challenge.
And that's one of the reasons why I think internal gratitude is so appealing to people, because you don't have to acknowledge that you are in need or were in need or receive something you couldn't have come up with yourself.
Give credit to somebody else.
It can all be there doesn't have to be any public acknowledgement of need.
Practicing gratitude outwardly requires some sense of vulnerability, because even though it's a positive thing you're doing, very likely it would be received well by people. You're still putting yourself in a position of vulnerability to do that. And people are apparently, especially in today's day and age, resistant to vulnerability. And being able to turn towards just some inward